Welcome to the Security Perimeter Podcast, an island of insanity, starring my dad, Athanasios Christoulos. This is an amazing podcast, really the best. You're gonna love it, guaranteed, 100%. We are gonna make podcasting great again, promise. And now, my dad, Athanasios, aka Saki Christoulos.
So, welcome to part two of why the Russians are wrong in thinking that they are the only ones who won World War II. This one gets into a bit more detail, and another very important point is that this time the audio quality is a lot better because I finally figured out how to use the little portable Samson microphone that I bought for my podcast, sabbatical in order to be able to do my podcast. So it's a really cool mic. It's really small, but it's supposed to like behave like a big mic, if you know what I mean. I guess it takes some getting used to. So without any further ado, here we go to part two. Just to remind you what we were talking about in the last episode, was the brutality of not only the Germans in the occupied territories in the east, but also the so-called Soviet guerrillas, you know, who were supporting the regime back in Moscow, who were supporting Stalin, the brutality that they inflicted upon the civilian population in those occupied territories. In other words, behind the front line between the Germans and the Russians. So I think you're gonna like this one a little bit more, not only because of the sound quality, but also because the content is we're really getting into it now, is what I'm trying to say. And it looks like this episode, like this series, might actually turn out to be 4 episodes as opposed to 3, but we'll see how many I can do in the next one. But they'll be coming weekly. No feedback. Thank you very much, as I asked. So please feedback. Listen, feedback. I did get some suggestions though, so that's pretty good. I got one to do on something on nuclear weapons. On Japan and the United States. So I did get that, but, you know, comments on whether or not you think this is interesting and something that I should continue to do on a regular basis. Not one email. Nope. So thank you very much. Hate you all. On to the podcast. I think the official estimates of how many Russians were slaughtered in the Eastern Front range from like 20 to 25 million. That's the number that the Russians and the Soviets used, and could very well be higher than that. I don't think we'll ever really, really know how many Russians or Soviet citizens were killed in the Second World War. To continue along the lines of what I was just saying a few moments ago, and what the Soviet government, what Stalin did to Soviet citizens, it's estimated that about a third of those 20 million were actually killed by Stalin's henchmen in the occupied territories, you know, the so-called communist rebels who are trying to defeat the Nazis from inside the occupied territories, and they were killing who they considered to be collaborators, and that number is about 6 million people. So when Vladimir Putin and the rest of the Russian leaders talk about the Great War and the great sacrifice that the Russian people make, I think it would be appropriate for him to add, not only single out the Germans as perpetrators of these crimes against humanity, but also Stalin himself. Look, Stalin, during the purges, which had occurred before the Second World War began, the purges were an economic reorganization of the country, especially in Ukraine, what was Ukraine at that time. But also there were some political executions. Essentially, Stalin, in these purges, got rid of anybody who he considered to be a threat to him. Those purges, the numbers are about 30 million people were killed by Stalin. So to say that 6 million, or to say that about a third of Soviets were killed by Stalin inside, this occupied territory, by the Germans, I mean, it's a reasonable number, and it's a number that's generally recognized by academics, and it's inconceivable that a country's own government would kill 6 million of its own citizens in a war, and then add that 6 million to the overall losses, claiming that the Russians made this great sacrifice in this great patriotic war, yet not acknowledge the fact that they were responsible, and I'm going to say it again, for 6 million of their own citizens being killed. They purposely shot them, killed them, tortured them, accused them of being collaborators with the Germans. That was basically the argument that they used to say that they were, they would say that you're either collaborators with the Nazis, or you're collaborating with the Ukrainian separatists. Either way, you're a collaborator, and therefore we're going to shoot you. To switch gears a little bit, in the beginning of the podcast, I argued that the Soviets basically had no strategy, and the Germans had like a attention deficit disorder strategy, where the Nazi leadership in Berlin would say, oh, let's go after Moscow this week, and then change their mind, and oh, let's go after Stalingrad, let's go after the Caucasus in the south, and so that's basically what the Eastern Front looked like. So the first real big battle to take place, the first really significant battle to take place in the Eastern Front, that was notable in the sense that there were heavy losses on both sides, but it actually turned out to be a tremendous victory for the Russians. It essentially turned the war around. It was, interestingly enough, the first time that the Russians decided to actually plan a strategy, come up with a strategy, other than just, throwing bodies at the Germans, which is what they had been doing for the entire previous year. So, I mean, think about this. Between August of 1941 until, when does the, I got the beginning of Stalingrad right here, until the beginning of Stalingrad, which started around August of 1942, so we're talking about a year. It was basically Germans trying to figure out a way how to break through, getting bogged down in the winter, outside of when that winter finally came, and Russians just essentially throwing bodies at the Soviets. An important footnote here is that when the Japanese attacked the United States in December of 1941, the Russians were able to take a significant amount of troops away from the Pacific, because, of course, the Russians were worried about a possible Japanese invasion. But when the Russians realized that the target for the Japanese wasn't Russia, but was rather the United States. Russia was able to move a significant amount of troops in the hundreds of thousands, maybe close to 1 million troops from the Pacific to the Eastern Front to fight the Germans. So there's another way in which, I guess, the United States helped Russia in the Second World War. But getting back to the Battle of Stalingrad, which takes place, which started in August and finished around August of 1942 and finished in about February of 1943. I mean, this was like apparently one of the most brutal fighting that has ever taken place. This was like literally hand-to-hand combat. The city was, not only was the city split between, you know, what was occupied by the Germans and what was occupied by the Russians, but there were places where, you know, some floors of a building were Soviet and some floors of a building were Russian. I mean, can you just imagine what the combat looked like in Stalingrad at that time? But I don't want to get into too much details about the brutality of Stalingrad. If you wish, you can read about it on your own. I will give you some numbers at the end to sort of wrap up this discussion. But this was my point here is that this was the first time that the Russians decided to use a strategy, and the strategy was that they were going to try. The Germans had concentrated all their forces to try to capture Stalingrad. So they were essentially, what's the word I'm looking for? They left their rear flank almost completely open. So, in other words, the rear flank, the rear side, you know, the behind just going to stick to the rear flank. The rear flank was almost completely open. And the reserve forces that were behind the German forces who were fighting in Stalingrad were all of Germany's allies, like Italy and Bulgaria. So you can imagine the quality of these troops. So what the Russians did was they did a pincer movement, and they kind of surrounded the Germans, or started to surround the Germans. As this was happening, the German general who's in charge of the Germans, General Paulus, is contacting Berlin and requesting that he retreat his forces because there's a risk of encirclement, and the order that he receives from Berlin is no. In fact, the order said you're gonna fight to the last man. And again, this is like, you know, thank God the Nazis were actually telling the German generals what to do, because if the German generals had decided on their own how to run this war, there's a possibility Germany could have won this war, but because the Nazis were leadership was just so stupid, and made such stupid calls, this one being one of the biggest ones, to not allow Paulus's troops to retreat, the Nazis essentially made it easier for both the United States, Great Britain, and the Soviet Union to win the war. But so the German and Bulgarian and Italian forces were eventually encircled completely by the Russian forces. And they fought on for a little while. The Germans tried to resupply Paulus's forces with some aircraft, dropping supplies. But it was winter, and when that was going on, and well, the weather wasn't so great, and they just couldn't keep Paulus's forces supplied. So Paulus contacts Berlin again and says, hey, We're going to get slaughtered here. There's no point in fighting anymore. May I surrender? And the response by Berlin was, surprise, surprise. No, you need to fight to the last man. So at this point, Paul is like thinking, Hitler is like absolutely insane. He's going to risk the lives of hundreds of thousands of Germans just to make a point, maybe. I don't know exactly what Hitler was thinking and what the rest of the Nazis in Berlin were thinking, but man, was that a stupid decision. Because eventually, of course, the Germans decided to disobey. The Germans in Stalingrad decided to disobey. Paulus, General Paulus, decides to disobey the order to fight to the last man. And he surrenders to the Russians. And this was like the first great major victory on the part of the Russians. And it really, you know, honestly, most historians look at Stalingrad as sort of like the point at which the war turned in favor of the Soviets. And don't forget, a lot of those troops that were fighting in Stalingrad were there because the Americans were fighting the Japanese, and Stalin was able to move those troops that were in the Pacific right to Stalingrad so that they can take on the Germans, right? So the Americans were, by fighting the Japanese, are relieving a significant amount of troops, helping, in other words, Stalin fight in Stalingrad. Names the city after himself. We're going to name a city after Saki. Saki Stein. Actually kind of sounds good. Or let's see, Athanasiosville. Because I'm in Montreal right now. I'm on sabbatical, so it would be Sakiville. Sakiville. Sakiville, that works. Yeah, the Quebecois accent. Sakiville. So, this is the modesty that Stalin has, that he names a city after himself. But just to give you here a bit of a summary of the casualties that were taken by the Axis powers. This is the combined, German, Italian, Hungarian, Romanian. I think the Bulgarians are there too as well. About 900, between 650,000 and 900,000 casualties and losses. That means dead, injured, and captured. And to do this, the Russians had to use up, I guess, is the sick word to use in this point, about 1.2 million soldiers, casualties in total. That means about 500,000 killed and about 650,000 wounded or sick. Now, you know, given the size of Russia and its population, this hit of a million, a little bit over a million, was nothing compared to the hit that the Germans took of about 900, let's say at a maximum of 900,000. And not only are the Germans losing, you know, between 650 and 900,000 soldiers, but they've also lost those German soldiers that were extremely well trained and prepared for war, had gone through an extensive period of training before the war began. And what's going to happen is that after Stalingrad, Hitler is going to have to rely more and more on conscripts who have not the best training. You know, they're not getting the best of training. In fact, things get so desperate that eventually Hitler puts 12-year-olds in uniform to fight. And there were 12-year-olds in uniform fighting in Berlin, and there were, I think, 12-year-olds fighting in uniform in Normandy as well. So I think if I use a microphone like this, it's gonna work a lot better. I'll test it in a second. But one of the claims, of course, that the Russians made, and I mentioned that in the beginning, was that the Americans and the Eastern, I'm sorry, the Americans and the Brits and the rest of the Western allies didn't help the Russians in at all. And one of the big things, one of the big problems, of course, for the Russians was equipment. And one of the big advantages of that the United States had was its ability to produce. So I was able to find this data that covers the period from the beginning of the invasion, the German invasion of Russia in August of 1941 until the end of the war. And the Russians received almost 15,000 planes from the Americans, 12,000 armored vehicles, that's tanks, armored personnel carriers, 12,000 armored vehicles, 400,000 vehicles, regular automobiles, almost 2,000 locomotives, and 35,000 motorcycles. So there was some help coming from the West, in spite of the fact that Stalin and later on Putin claimed that the West really didn't do much to support the Soviet Union during the Second World War. So one of the more, let's say, significant arguments on the part of the Russians with respect to this argument that they, you know, they won the war was the fact that the West didn't initiate a military campaign in Europe proper until June of 1944, and the argument being on the part of the Russians, of course, by that time the Germans were no longer a force. So let's take a look at that argument for a second now. So I guess we're now we're getting into the the meat of the discussion. Well, when the United States enters the war, the United States is not prepared for war. It was sort of like what happened in World War I, where the United States enters the war but then takes a number of months to put itself together militarily in order to do something. Well, the same thing kind of happened in the Second World War. So the United States declares war on Japan in December of 1941, but really, really doesn't have any ability to act militarily speaking until more or less the spring or summer of 1942, when they launched Operation Torch. Sorry, I got the date wrong. November of 1942. The Americans, along with British, launched Operation Torch, which was landing in North Africa. The Russians were all kind of landing in North Africa to try to, you know, help the British, who were getting their butts kicked by Rommel in Egypt. The main complaint on the part of the Russians was like, why are you focusing on Africa? You're only trying to protect British colonial interests. You're not really interested in the war. Well, I mean, to begin with, Operation Torch, from a military standpoint, really was the only thing that the United States could actually do. So they wanted to do something. And remember, they're fighting the Japanese, you know, on the Pacific, which is indirectly helping the Russians, as we discussed before. But they were able to put together something to land in North Africa to help the British against someone who became known as probably the best general in the German army, Erwin Rommel. There were ups and downs on the campaign. You know, the Americans had to kind of learn how to use tanks. There's this famous battle, the Battle of Kesselring, where the United States took some pretty heavy losses. But the thing about the Americans was that they would learn very, very quickly from their mistakes. The Kesselring error, so to speak, taught the Americans quite a bit about how to use tanks in in combat, the person in particular who learned quite a bit from the from that fiasco, I guess, in Kesselring was Patton, who I believe is, in spite of the fact that he's a nutcase, racist, anti-Semite, anything you want to call, you know, you name it, Patton was, you know, the American's best general. So he learned quite a bit from North Africa. Now, these lessons that Patton learns in North Africa, he's going to later apply in Europe. And those lessons, or rather, those tactics that Patton used in Europe devastated the German army in the West. But we'll get to that in a second. So, you know, so Stalin is pretty angry at the fact that, you know, the only thing that the Americans and the British are doing are landing forces in North Africa, and Stalin wants a landing in Europe. Stalin wants the Americans and the British to land in France. The problem is that Stalin doesn't recognize that the Americans really, honestly, the Allies, the Western Allies, really do not have the capacity yet to launch such an invasion of Europe. What I want to say is that, you know, by 1942, the United States and Great Britain simply do not have the military equipment, or the men for that matter, to launch an invasion of Europe. And they're not going to have that ability until late 1943, 1944. And you know what? We know that how weak the Western Allies were with respect to a landing on the French coast, which is again what Stalin wanted, because they tried a sort of like a practice invasion, a small practice invasion in August of 1942. It's an invasion of a failed invasion of France. That's very famous in Canada because it was predominantly Canadians who landed on the beaches in Dieppe in France to essentially test the tactics, test the equipment. I guess I should add this, that for those of you who don't know where Dieppe is, it's in Normandy, a little bit north from where the Allies actually landed in Normandy. It's closer to Calais. The idea was to hold Dieppe for a certain amount of time, destroy some German assets, and then evacuate. And essentially test the ability of the West to invade France. And it turned out to be a complete disaster. So the Canadians landed about 6,000 men on the beaches, and close to 4,000 of those, about 3,700, were either killed, wounded, or captured. So, I mean, that the Dieppe raid really taught the West a lesson, the Western Allies a lesson, about what was needed to launch an invasion of France. And it was pretty clear that, you know, in 1942, precisely the moment when Stalin is insisting that the West launch this continental invasion, it's pretty clear that the West simply does not have the equipment, the tactics, or the number of troops, for that matter, to do that. So, Roosevelt wanted to do something, and that's why going into North Africa was kind of, a test for the Americans, a test for what they were going to do later, what they did later in Italy, when they landed in Italy, and then eventually when they landed, along with the British and, of course, the Canadians in Normandy in June of 1944. Sorry, yeah, one other thing that I forgot to mention was that the invasion of Normandy couldn't take place as long as a German Air Force existed. These transport ships were going to be extremely vulnerable if the Germans still had an air force. Therefore, one of the objectives of the Western Allies before an invasion could take place, an invasion of Normandy could take place, was that the German air force had to be destroyed. Again, this is an issue of what are we doing exactly now? I mean, we're blaming the Western Allies for being smart, for planning, for making sure that the risk involved in such an operation is as minimal as possible. Well, yeah, sure. If that's the case, then yes, the West is guilty of not doing anything in the Second World War. So, Dieppe was a pretty significant lesson for the Western Allies in 1943. But let's step back for a second and take a look at what's happened in 1943. So, yes, we have Stalingrad. Stalingrad was critical in the sense that for the first time the Russians were able to make a strategic advance against the Germans. Hundreds of thousands of Germans surrendered, including the commander, General Paulus. It was a major victory for the Russians, and rightly so. The Russians put a lot of emphasis on Stalingrad and its importance. But at the same time that Stalingrad's taking place, there's a couple of other things that are going on that are pretty important as well, that are having a significant effect on the morale of the German population and the soldiers back home in Berlin. Hitler is starting to feel the pressure. Public opinion is beginning to turn against not only the Nazi project, but Hitler himself. This is something that had not been seen in 1939, 1940, 1941. So by 1943, there's a lot of pressure. Part of the reason for the pressure is Stalingrad, yes, of course. But part of the reason for this pressure is the fact that the Germans have just gotten their asses kicked in North Africa. They've been essentially booted out of the African continent, the underbelly, I guess, maybe another, the underbelly of Europe. And Italy, as an ally, has demonstrated its inability to really make any contribution for Germany. For those who don't know this, North Africa had been Hitler wasn't really interested in North Africa. In fact, North Africa was a place that where the British were, and the Germans really didn't care about the British Empire. At some point, they were willing to actually negotiate with the British, where they would tell them, you keep your empire, we keep Europe. But the Italians were fighting in North Africa. They considered it, their space. And that brought the Italians into direct confrontation with the British. And the Italian inability to fight in North Africa was the reason why the Germans got involved in the first place. Another area where the Germans had to were kind of forced to get involved because of Italian military incompetence was Greece, of all places, me being Greek. the Italians considered Greece to be a part of the, you know, the greater Roman Empire, so they tried to invade Greece, and they got their butts kicked so bad that not only did the Greeks stop the German advance, I'm sorry, the Italian advance, but they actually, you know, pushed their Italian army backwards, and it actually looked like the Italian army was going to collapse, and that the Greeks were going to invade Italy. And it's at that point that Germans have to get involved more directly in Greece. And some people argue that me being one of them, sort of, kind of like for fun, that Greece won World War II because Hitler was preparing at that time when he decides that he needs to help the Italians in Greece. He's supposed to be launching Operation Barbarossa. He wanted to launch Operation Barbarossa in early May of 1941. But because the Italians were getting their butts kicked, he had to postpone it. A lot of the equipment and troops that were going to be used in Barbarossa had to be diverted for Greece, and Barbarossa ultimately was postponed until the end of June. And Greeks like to think that Greece actually literally won the Second World War. I think the Germans lost the East for a little bit more than just the winter, that first winter. In other words, starting the war late, starting it in June instead of May. Yeah, sure. As a Greek, I'm going to be a good nationalist and say that Greece won the Second World War. So, in summary, the Allied successes in Africa were also significant in affecting the mood, let's say, back home in Germany. And then finally, and importantly, was the constant bombing that was taking place in 1943 on the part of the by the Allies against German cities, some of the major cities. You know, these bombings didn't really have, in 1943 anyways, they really didn't have any real significant impact on the economic capacity of Germany, or the ability of Germany to produce you know, equipment for war. But what it did do is that the bombing was so significant that it leveled literally, you know, 50% of Munich and 60% of some other city and 75% of some other city. I mean, they literally laid waste to these cities. And the effect on German population was, well, they were starting to realize that there was a war going on. You know, up until all those victories that had, you know, had come so easy, up to and including the war with France, things were great at home in Berlin. All of a sudden, the Germans are starting to feel the cost of a prolonged war. The other thing, of course, is if you're a German soldier and you're getting news about how badly Germany is, the cities are getting bombed. I mean, how does that affect you in terms of your ability to fight, let's say, in the Eastern Front, for example? So the bombing was had a significant psychological effect, not only on the population but also on the actual soldiers themselves. But I do want to give one specific example that took place in 1942-43. So you remember, I mentioned that the economic effect wasn't that great, but just in one bombing raid, and a bombing raid would last over a few days. They would call them 1,000 bomber raids. It would literally send in 1,000 bombers in Hamburg. in that 1943, in a bombing raid over Hamburg, they killed the Allies, the Western Allies, killed 30,000 civilians, left 500,000 people without homes, leveled 50% of the city. And that was just in one bombing run. So this is starting to have such a significant, such an important effect on German population that Hitler decides to put this nutcase, real nutcase, Himmler, as Minister of the Interior. And that was significant because Himmler was known for his repression. Himmler was actually known for his extermination of the Jews, but Himmler was known for his repressive policies. And putting him as Minister of the Interior in 1943 is telling you that the German population no longer sees Hitler as this great savior. They have to put somebody in there who's going to implement repressive policies against the German population, because there's, I mean, I imagine there's concern that the German population may try something. You know, I mean, and think about this. I mean, sure, yes, the Germans are fighting the Russians, and the Russians are throwing literally everything they have, and that's, I don't want to underplay that. Like I keep on saying, it's a significant contribution. But the Nazis are being attacked from literally every corner. They're being attacked from the south in North Africa. They're having their cities bombed the crap out of. The pressure on Hitler and the Nazi regime in 1943 is significant, and the reason for that isn't only because of what the Russians were doing. There's one more thing that I forgot to mention. The famous Battle of the Atlantic, which was another serious pain in the ass of the Nazis in starting in 1943. A lot of the supplies that Great Britain was getting was coming from the United States and Canada. And in 1941 and 1942, well, in 1942, the Germans had a lot of success in sinking those supply ships. And then, you know, the Allies kind of figured out how to do it. They figured out that the best way to get these supply ships over to, from, let's say, Canada to Great Britain was in a convoy system, where these transport ships and supply ships were escorted by destroyers and frigates and so forth. And they were able to absolutely devastate the German Navy, especially the U-boats, those submarines that the Germans were using to sink those transport ships. I think in just 1943, the Germans lost about 50 U-boats and over 1,000 men. So the Battle of the Atlantic was also not going so good for the Germans. Now, I mean, think of yourself if you're Hitler right now. You have to deal with the German. You have to deal with the Russians in Stalingrad. You have to deal with the British and the Americans in North Africa. You know they're coming after you in Italy. Your Italian ally is a complete, total, freaking, fucking moron. You have the Americans and the British bombing the crap out of your cities. And your attempt to stop the supply of the British Isles with the U-boats is starting to fail. Things are really not going too good for you by 1943, Mr. Hitler, and only one of the reasons is because of what the Russians are doing. Alright, so we are at the end of episode 2 of why the Russians are wrong in thinking that they were the only ones who defeated the Nazis, some other people. There's going to be an episode 3 for sure, obviously, and quite possibly an episode 4. And I just wanted to mention that the song you were listening to in the beginning of the podcast was from the Glenn Miller Band, a famous band from that time. It comes from a CD collection that's called The Songs That Won the War, and I highly recommend it. It's loads of fun. And this song right now that you're listening to, well, I'll leave it as a surprise. Maybe it'll get you to email me if you guess the song right. Buy you a Carlos Quinto chocolate bar. I don't know. A bag of chips. Anyways, so until next week, have a good one.
It's not the